you know, even for touch, right? You know, we still don't fully understand it, right? I think robots are obviously these days the robots are become more and more fancier, but they still are not as good as our human fingers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I think part of that is because we don't fully understand the sense of touch and how we use it, sort of in an online feedback manner to control our fingers.
The human brain is the most complex structure in the known universe, and we are in the middle of a scientific revolution to understand its inner workings. Join us for a conversation with world-renowned neuroscientists as they visit Rochester. I am Dr. John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and you are listening to Neuroscience Perspectives.
I'm John Fox. I'm the director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. Today, we're very, very pleased to have with us a guest from all the way from Boston here to Rochester, where it's a frigid day indeed. Professor Fan Wang, who is professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the world famous McGovern Institute for Brain Sciences at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Fan, it's really wonderful to have you here today to
My
chat
pleasure.
With us. And you know, I know you study touch, sensation of touch, and have had a specific interest in touch and pain.
Yes.
And more recently, this has evolved into looking towards more efficacious treatments for drug addiction. That's quite a span of work there. Let's hear a little bit about, you know, how did you get into studying touch, and what about that was of particular interest to you?
As a PhD student, I worked with Richard Axel, and I studied smell. And it was a really fun time. I had really a best of time in my life as a graduate student. And as I finishing up and I was looking for postdocs, and I was thinking, which area should I get into? And I remembered in graduate school, we always talk about this, you know, there's a olfactory sensory map. And then, but then who is reading the map, right? And then Richard used to say, there's no ghost in the machine, right?
Uh-huh.
So that always made me wonder, because we always say, I am looking, I am smelling, I am feeling, right? So who am I? And then I was deeply interested in understanding this question. What gave us a sense of self? Who am I? And I figured I needed to study something related to the body, because when we talk about ourselves, we always point at our own body, right?
Uh-huh.
So that made me wanted to study touch, so also somatic sensation, the bodily senses. So that is sort of the fundamental reason why I decided to go into the bodily sensations.
And it's an amazing connection you've just made between something so fundamental, the sense of touch and the maps of touch, And a deep philosophical question: who am I? I'm here, and I love the expression, "No ghost in the machine."
Yes,
help our viewers and listeners understand that. You know, what do we mean by that? The ghost in the machine.
Yeah. So if you look into the brain, you can find somatosensory cortex, visual cortex, auditory cortex, motor cortex, but it's always like there is an I there, right? I feel as if there is someone looking at your somatosensory cortex telling you what you're feeling or what you're moving or what you're seeing. So, but if you look at it, there's no region in the brain that is an I, right?
Mm-hmm.
Me, I, self. So what is that? And I don't know. I still don't know what is the question. That's what scientists mean. There's no ghost in the machine. There's no a soul in the particular region in the brain, even though we think neuroactivity is sort of the basis for the sense of self. But who is this knower?
Yeah,
reader of the brain activity?
So I think you know, this is a sort of standard. A lot of the paradigms, the models we use, boil down to some little man or woman pulling the levers in there, switching back and forth. But of course, that's you yourself, and how that self is represented. And we talk about things like emergent properties of like the network dynamics of a brain, but this is still a complete mystery, really.
Still a complete mystery. Yeah. Yes,
I love how you've related something quite fundamental, really, in the study of touch. Tell us about then from touch to pain and why that's important.
If I may be truly honest with you, okay, so when I was writing touch grant application for R01s, and you always try to relate to human health, right?
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Course, yeah.
So initially, I'm really only interested in touch. But then when you try to write grant, it seems that touch can become painful in neuropathic conditions. So there's a lot more pain opportunity there. So that was initial, I just made that conceptual link, touch can become painful. But then over the years, it actually really become a deep interest of mine. And I really decided the pain is what I also truly, fundamentally, and both scientifically, and as a scientist, I feel like it's my society duty that I'm interested in pain, because pain, especially chronic pain, affecting so many people.
Yeah.
That's now a very big area of research in my lab.
Fantastic. And yeah, I mean, this is such an extraordinarily unmet need in the community. So many people suffering from chronic pain, with very little in the line of solutions. And of course, we've been through a huge opioid epidemic on the backs of trying to help people with chronic pain issues. Can you draw that link for us then between, you know, really fundamental mapping of your fingers and your joints in cortex and this transition into a chronic pain condition? How do you see that?
Yeah, actually today in my talk, I will actually talk about it. What is the role of the sensory cortex in somatosensory cortex in pain, right? Because we study touch as a clear map in the somatosensory cortex. So Panfield, many years ago, stimulated the brain. And if you stimulate the sensory cortex, you evoke sensations. And that's always tactile sensation, touch sensation.
Yeah.
No matter how strong you stimulate the somatosensory cortex, you never evoke pain.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. Right?
Just for our listeners, Penfield was a great neurologist, neurosurgeon. And when we were talking about stimulating the brain, he was literally in true craniotomy, stimulating directly onto the human brain while they were having brain surgery. So.
Yeah. Yet you do know which part of your body feel pain, right?
Yeah.
So there is a localization. And then you know what kind of pain you feel, like it's, you know, prickling, or it's just a dull pain and all of these things. So that seems you do require sensory cortex. However, why is it that stimulating the sensory cortex never evoke pain, right? So pain must have another component. So the only area in cortex that Penfield stimulated that evoke pain is part of the insular. Okay, so when he stimulated the insular cortex, the patients can, sometimes have a pain sensation.
Interesting.
In fact, pain has two components, right? One is this sensory component. The other is this emotional component. Mm. I would argue without this emotional suffering component, then it's not pain, it's just an intense sensation. So my interest in pain, from touch perspective, I feel like touch give you a location and also a sort of a train your system have a fine discrimination. Mm-hmm. Right? So that helps you to localize the pain and also help discriminate the pain. And that helps you to pay attention to which part of your body you're in pain. Whereas there is a separate system that encodes emotional aspect. So my work is trying to link both these aspects together to derive a full understanding of pain. And I think in case of chronic pain, if you do chronic pain patient with functional MRI, the somatosensory cortex is not so activated. It's actually sort of seems to be amygdala, you know, insular, or the other sort of emotional regions.
And limbic structures.
Limbic structure.
And so it's the persistence of this emotional reactivity and some kind of an iterative process then that just it deeply encodes this. And it's so hard then for folks to get out of it.
Exactly.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
And we don't really have effective medications for this.
No. Opioids, it's the thing, right? And unfortunately, it
can
cause dependence addictions.
Can we go back? You know, you said something very interesting, and I suspect there are many scientists out there. I know it really resonated with me, which is you start out studying something very basic, and you do it for the pure knowledge of it. And you end up through the pragmatics of the grant system and the funding system, and it's not unreasonable, the taxpayer pays for our work, mm-hmm. for them to say, I want you to be doing something that has pertinence and relevance to our health system. After all, we get our money from the National Institute of Health. And of course, then that took you up and became a passion too. And I have to say that's exactly parallel to how my own career went. But I do think it's important, right, for people to understand that sometimes you need to just study something for the pure knowledge of it without the specter of the funding engine or the motivation of a disease model, because finding out how things work in and of itself is important.
I completely agree. That's why I study the whisker system, the rodent whisker. They use whiskers as tactile sensors. And I remember every time I publish something, I tell my mother, she's in China, she's like, why should I care, right? Yeah. But it was like, but I care. I find it super interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just like, I think I did it and I'm still doing it for the sake of curiosity. And yeah. I find it a fascinating topic and system to study. But I do understand scientists has also society duties.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think, even for touch, right, we still don't fully understand it, right? I mean, I think robots are obviously these days the robots are become more and more fancier, but they still are not as good as our human fingers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I think part of that is because we don't fully understand the sense of touch and how we use it, sort of in an online feedback manner to control our fingers.
Yeah, yeah. And developmentally too. I mean, right, touch, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm no expert in this, but this is the first and most basic formative sense, right? This is what an infant coming from the womb is, this somatosensation and smell and really, and attachment to the mother is very, very connected to touch. And then our emotional health is very connected to how touch impacts us across early development.
Absolutely, right. There was a study in Romania that infants left, not being hugged, they don't develop well. Some of them even died, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So touch is absolutely essential. And it also sets the boundary, right, of yourself versus, the rest of the world. So that's why I, coming back to my interest in understanding self is really, it's a touch sensory receptors all over your body, right? That give you a boundary. You are in this body. Right?
Yeah.
So I think it also really is the fundamental sense for who you are and why you are in this body. You embody this body, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. You mentioned your mom in China. So let's talk about you. You grew up in China and you studied in China early. I have it on good authority that you were very interested in science very early in life. Tell us about that. Why did that passion develop? Is it something from your family or was it just curiosity?
I would say it's probably just curiosity. And also part of that is I'm always a nerdy child. So socially, I don't feel like I have lots of friends or I get along with other kids. But when I read scientific books or when I'm just studying it, I'm totally in my element. So honestly, I am always the number one student from, elementary school, middle school, high school, and college. So I'm just a sort of a nerd. I think it's probably genetics.
I'm proud of it.
Yes. It's good. Yeah. Good. So I know I'm always going to be a scientist. Yeah.
You did.
Yeah.
Could you quantify that? How early are we talking about?
As early as in middle school,
I just find it
reading scientific books. I a lot of things I learn on my own. So yeah. I'm just so interested in learning everything. I find it more interesting than go out with friends.
It's very interesting. So you really drawn to the science components of, schooling. And then when it came to things like the humanities and that, were you walking away from them or did you bring them along with you at the same time? Like your literature and...
I am good at tests. In a Chinese system, you have to do well in tests to rise to the top. So that's study, right?
Yeah.
I can study. I study humanity, you know, and all of that. I have a really good memory. Mm-hmm. I think in the Chinese education system, if you have a good memory, you can do very well in tests.
Yeah.
So I think I probably just have a very good memory. I memorize things very well. I would not say I have a deep interest in the sort of literature or history.
Right.
I'm just more of a STEM.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. So tell us then how. So you did your university in Tsinghua.
In Beijing.
And then what brought you to the States? How did that come about? Or was that always the plan?
No. So I would honestly say that I didn't think about going abroad, but I got into Tsinghua in 1988 in the fall. 1989 is the Tiananmen Square event.
Right.
So I was on the ground on Tiananmen Square for 2 months.
Goodness me.
Yeah,
okay.
So that obviously in the end led to the crackdown and all that. At that moment, I felt like I need to leave here. I felt like I do need a country that you can sort of express and have some freedom, right?
And
all that, and democracy. So the whole thing started as a democratic demonstration, and that turned out obviously sadly and sadly. Looking back at that time, I just felt like I need to get out of China.
Uh-huh.
It was too much of a dictatorship and that. So that motivated me. Then I, you know, studied English and did well in TOEFL and GRE and applied. And
you applied those good test-taking skills.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm also very lucky because at that time, Columbia sent a person to China to interview these applicants.
Right.
And I interviewed well, so I got an offer from Columbia. So I went to Columbia for my PhD.
And that's where you met Richard Axel,
and it takes off
from there.
Yeah.
And then your trajectory. So you did your PhD at Columbia, and then you were a postdoc at Stanford, is that right?
Right. So Mark Tresilla Levine is my mentor. He was at UCSF. So we started UCSF, then we moved to Stanford. So I would just simplify it as a Stanford.
Yeah. And a big chunk of your career at Duke University.
Yes, yes.
Somewhat warmer climes.
17 years in Duke.
17 years in Duke. Mm. So you're quite some time now in the United States. I really appreciate you getting into how politics interfaced with, you know, your love of science and coming to, you know, free country. I mean, I'm an immigrant as well, and you know, there's great attraction to America, especially for anybody interested in the sciences. We won't go too deep into politics, but we must distress you a little bit to see the politics of today and worry about, you know, where freedom and the science engine is going.
It does worry me a little bit, but I've now taking more of a Zen approach. I've decided whatever it is, it is. We'll just deal with it.
We're
right?
back to philosophy. Excellent.
Yes, yes.
Excellent. Now, there's a drug addiction component. So how do we go from touch to pain to addiction? I think we probably know a little bit, but tell us about that.
Yeah. So that, again, is actually a new project after I moved to MIT.
Uh-huh.
And I, at the time, thought, okay, now I got this new fancy startup. I want to really do something even more helping the people and society.
Right, yeah.
So, and that, as you said, this opioid pandemic, opioid epidemic, sorry.
Yeah.
My English sometimes
No,
is
that's
not very
that's
good.
Perfectly fine.
So, and I felt like it's because I study pain, right? And then a lot of people become opioid dependent because opioid is the prescription drug for treating chronic pain. So I felt like it's my duty as a scientist and to study this. So it's a new direction, and I'm very fortunate to have recruited a postdoc, and I have two technicians working on it. It's a difficult question to tackle in a way. When I was talking to donors, Well, because this is not NIH funded. I haven't had any prior publication in this area. Therefore, it's impossible
so to
get. So I have to publish first. So they're trying to talk to the donors. And then what I got is two responses. Okay. First is, why do you study this? People can just stop taking the drugs.
If only that were true.
Yeah, they blame the people themselves.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Okay, very sad. And the second response is there is National Institute of Drug Addiction, right? NIDA. It's been there for 30 years. If they haven't come up with anything, what are you going to do?
Uh-huh.
That's so different.
Wow. And people have actually said that to you.
Uh-huh.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hard question. I mean, the first one, obviously, it's easy
to
address, right? A lot of times it's not their fault. And it's not as simple as, you know, their lack of will, right? It's really, truly a disease.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's actually a brain body disease. It's not just here. It's their entire physiology is altered by the drug, making it so hard to overcome the addiction. Now, the second question I have thought very hard, yes, what am I going to do, right? But you can almost ask the same question for almost every area of research, right? For pain, NINDS has been funding pain for also years. So I thought, okay, I need to do something a little bit more unique, right? A niche. So the gold standard in the addiction field is to develop an animal model of self-administration of drugs, right?
So we
developed this in mice, which is somewhat harder than rat because mouse has a very small vein. You can put a catheter in and then hook up to a pump. And when the mouse press the lever, they will get intravenous infusion, right? So we developed a model for cocaine self-administration and fentanyl administration, and then they work very nicely. So what happens that hasn't been done in these animal models are in vivo monitoring of neural activities.
Right.
In these tasks. So that's what I'm doing. So
So
we're doing a lot of, obviously, the obvious things is dopamine sensor, you know, fiber photometry in different regions.
Yeah, yeah.
But the more sophisticated ones are multi-electro recordings from multiple brain regions simultaneously.
Right.
It's the reason that it is hard is the mouse is doing these tasks, right, with all these hookups. And if you have an electrode, the mouse move around, these two systems can tangle.
Sure, of course.
So the mouse stopped doing it. So you have to solve the technical issue.
Working in extraordinarily small spaces.
Yes, exactly.
With critters that don't necessarily want to just comply with what you have to do.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, actually. So this drug self-administration model is very well known in the neurosciences. Does every mouse self-administer, or is it a subpopulation?
Good question. It's a spectrum. Okay, some self-administer more, some self-administer less. So we're also trying to figure out.
Which, of course, goes right back to, you know, there's some mice who can help themselves, mm-hmm. and there's others who can take it or leave it. And if you're a person who can take it or leave it, it can be hard to put yourself into the position of somebody who just can't live without.
Exactly.
We all need a little bit more compassion. You know, you started out talking about, you know, being a child that maybe didn't socialize so much and didn't worry so much about people because you were concentrated on your science. But one thing that's coming out loud and clear is your compassion for the people who are suffering out there. And I think that's a really nice aspect of the work that you're doing. It's clear that human suffering is at the back end of what you're trying to do.
Part of that is because I growing up and then become more mature and then be in science field longer and longer, I realize it's not about me, right? Whatever I do, it's no fun if it's only about me, my fame and my success. I publish another paper. And whatever I do, there's all these and resources and supports and then, you know, taxpayers' money made me able to do what I want to do.
Right.
I felt like it's my turn. I have to return some of
I think that's an absolutely fantastic sentiment. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here in Rochester in this freezing cold day. We really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me here. Yeah.